Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for another Ogletree Deacons Podcast. My name is Keith Copland, and I'm a shareholder in the Milwaukee office of Ogletree Deacons. And here with me today is Sarah Platt, my colleague.
Hi, Keith.
So today we're going to talk about Managing Family and Medical Leave Act at the federal level. And one of the things I'll point out at the outset is the Family Medical Leave Act is a federal law, but we also have state laws. We've got 12 jurisdictions in the United States that have their own separate Family and Medical Leave Act requirements. We're not going to get into those. And we're also not going to touch on any paid sick leave issues. We're going to focus exclusively on Federal Family and Medical Leave Act leave. Now, as an attorney, I'm very excited about the fact that the Family and Medical Leave Act has dozens and dozens of regulations covering virtually any question or any issue that can arise with respect to that leave. But we still have some complications and areas of confusion. Sarah, what is it about the Family and Medical Leave Act that you think makes it particularly difficult for some employers and some employees to understand and administer?
I think this is one of the laws that comes up, number one, most often for employers and employees. Everybody has, you know, medical issues in their lives, whether their own or family members, and the FMLA comes into play with respect to all of those. It's also one that overlaps with a number of other laws. So sometimes you get what they call the Bermuda Triangle. You get a situation where perhaps the FMLA, the ADA, maybe even workers' comp law, or as you mentioned, state and local laws, all apply to the circumstances at the same time. And so that can be difficult to administer as well, to keep all of those in mind and make sure that you're following the requirements of each law potentially simultaneously. And then it's one that really is a very fundamental interest for employees. People legitimately have medical issues that prevent them from being able to work, and they may be able to come back after leave and do their job well. But at the same time, it is a challenge for employers to manage those absences and still run the business and get the job done. And so it's one that is difficult to balance those interests. It's also one that inherently involves an area that none of us are experts in, right? We're not doctors. And the FMLA inherently involves evaluating medical information. And that's not our area of expertise. And that's one of the reasons that the law exists, right? To prevent us from playing doctor and making those medical determinations on our own.
Now, when we do have multiple areas of the law that might apply to a given circumstance, the general rule is that employees always get the benefit of the most favorable requirement or provision. So that's something to keep in mind as you're looking at these issues and you're looking at that Bermuda Triangle. Make sure that you are always giving consideration to what's most favorable for the employee in a given circumstance.
That's right. So for example, when the FMLA and the ADA apply, the FMLA governs time when the employee wants to be out of work. And if the circumstances fall under the FMLA and the employee says they want to use leave, an employer cannot, for example, say, well, there might be some other accommodation that would allow you to appear for work and do your job, which an employer can do under the ADA. But if the FMLA applies and that employee wants to take the leave, the employer doesn't have the right in that circumstance to impose or require a lesser accommodation. So it's absolutely true that while the laws apply simultaneously, it's the most generous law to the employee that's going to govern in a particular instance.
It's a good point. Now, in a general sense, the Family Medical Leave Act provides up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave in a leave year. Who's eligible for family and medical leave?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that I think sometimes employers who've been doing this a long time overlook. You know, we forget at the outset or at the time of a leave request to double check and make sure that an employee is covered. So first, the employee under the federal FMLA needs to work at a location where there are at least 50 employees within a 75-mile radius. Then there are also some requirements of the individual employee. So they need to have been employed for a year. Now, that year doesn't have to be consecutive. It generally, there's a look back period of about 7 years. The employee also has to work a requisite number of hours. And this is the one that really does sometimes come into play. They have to have worked 1,250 hours in the previous year to qualify for FMLA leave. And sometimes employees haven't. Either they haven't been employed long enough to hit that 1 year, or they haven't worked the 1,250 hours. For example, an employee who maybe worked in the past but has only been back working for the company for 3 months or something. So they would have hit the requirement to have worked for the company for a year, but wouldn't have worked 1,250 hours in the last year to qualify for FMLA leave.
And when an employee is in a situation where they might need family and medical leave, do they have to come to a supervisor or human resources and use the magic words, "I would like to take my Family and Medical Leave Act rights"?
Certainly not. So they need to let you know that they have a need for leave, but they absolutely don't have to use any magic words. They don't have to say, "I would like to invoke the Family and Medical Leave Act." Right. They can come and say, "Hey, I need surgery, or my child is having a medical issue and I'm going to need to miss some work." Or it may be that they've missed work and say, "Yeah, I've been, I was in the hospital, or I've been really sick." So any of those ways of letting the employer know that the employee may need FMLA should trigger the process and the paperwork. And that's another thing to point out, that there's a lot of paperwork that is called for under the FMLA. And I think employers, should try to look on the bright side of using that paperwork to their advantage, that they really are communication tools. So when you think the FMLA might apply, send out that eligibility notice and the rights and responsibilities so that we can all be on the same page and get more information to determine whether the law truly does come into play.
And a little tip here, when we're talking about administering the Family and Medical Leave Act and the employee giving notice of the need for leave, oftentimes that notice might come to a supervisor. It's not always going to be a formal channel coming to the human resource professional. So it's important that supervisors understand that if somebody calls in and says, "I'm in the hospital," or I need treatment, that they know they might need to elevate that to human resources or whomever's going to administer that paperwork for the employer.
Keep that in mind. Or the employee who has called in repeatedly for a migraine or for some recurring health issue. I've really had a great experience doing training with a couple of clients with both their frontline supervisors and their HR folks together on this issue, and helping each of them understand what the other needs. So they're all in a room together, and you can explain the requirements of the FMLA and let the supervisors know what the HR folks need from them, and let HR know what the supervisors need in order to best manage the circumstance, so that everybody is on the same page and the supervisors don't think HR is just throwing up roadblocks and HR doesn't think that the supervisors are just intentionally sitting on information. So getting everybody on the same team in managing this issue can be really helpful.
That's a great, great tip. Now, the Family Medical Leave Act is a great benefit for employees, and it provides unpaid leave unless there is a benefit that the employee would like to substitute in, maybe a paid sick leave option from the employer. But it's still one area that can extend for up to 12 weeks if it's the employee's own serious health condition. So what sorts of tools and tips do you have, Sarah, to help employers effectively manage the leave process?
Yeah, and I think this is a big challenge. I think that particularly when it's used intermittently, 12 weeks of leave can stretch out to be a really long time of intermittent use. And that's a real business challenge. And so I think it's important that employers, one, evaluate the situation on the front end to understand, does this really qualify for the FMLA? As I said before, use that paperwork to make sure that it is covered by the FMLA. Request a medical certification when the leave is for the employee's own serious health condition, and then review that medical certification. I work with some employers who sort of, once the certification comes back, it's a relatively cursory review, and they say, "Check that box, we've got it." But there's a lot of information on that form to help us determine whether or not the circumstances really are covered by the FMLA. Pretty much each question on the medical certification form aligns with one element of the regulations. And so you can use it to go through and determine, is this a serious health condition due to continuing treatment? So there's a box on there that says, how long has the employee been impaired? If it's not more than 3 days, the employee may not have a serious health condition. If the employee hasn't received treatment two or more times in the last year and they're claiming it's a chronic condition, it may not be covered by the FMLA. Using that information to determine whether the circumstances are covered is really important. The other piece that's on the certification form that's really important to make sure you have on the front end is the information from the last few questions where the certification form asks the doctor to identify how much intermittent leave the employee is likely to need. Sometimes doctors leave those questions blank because realistically it is difficult to estimate. But we do need to have the doctor at least provide an estimate because that gives us a sense of what we're looking at going forward and helps us make sure that the employee is using what the doctor would expect.
Now, when you get a certification and you're looking at it and scrutinizing it to make sure it's got all the information required for you to administer the leave, as Sarah indicated, sometimes necessary information is missing, or perhaps it's vague or it's ambiguous. That's going to trigger the right to cure, and you as the employer would have the opportunity, in fact, the obligation to provide written notice to the employee of how the certification might be defective, giving them 7 calendar days to cure that defect so you can have a complete and sufficient certification to help you assess whether there is a serious health condition entitling that individual to leave. So it's important you don't miss that opportunity because on the front end, this is when you can really understand what the condition is going to look like. And as you move forward, as Sarah indicated, you can manage to what those specifications are.
And it's important to remember that that process still goes through the employee. So it's still their responsibility to get the information from the doctor. You give them the certification form and perhaps also a cover letter to explain, here's the information that's missing, here's what we need. There are only 2 circumstances where the employer is allowed to contact the doctor directly, and that's to clarify or authenticate the certification form. And authenticate means asking the doctor, hey, did you really fill this out? You know, where you think perhaps the employee filled the form out themselves and signed the doctor's name or something like that. And clarification really is the old fashioned doctors having poor handwriting, saying, what does this say? I can't read the handwriting, or what does this word mean? Those are the only circumstances where the employer should be going to the doctor directly under the FMLA.
Now you get a certification back and you look at it and it says the employee is going to miss 1 day per week for the next month. Sarah, if that employee misses 2 days the first week for FMLA, can that employee be disciplined or terminated?
I wouldn't discipline or terminate at that point. I would go back and seek recertification. And so it's one of the circumstances where you can seek recertification right away if the employee is seeking more leave than what is certified on the form. And so it really is starting that process again, giving the employee that certification form, perhaps a cover letter explaining that they have already exceeded the amount of leave that the doctor estimated. I think one reason for doing that is to get the employer more information. Another is that it may spur a helpful conversation between the employee and their doctor. Whatever treatment they're seeking may not be working, or the issue might be more severe than what the doctor expects. And hopefully that conversation really will be helpful for the employee to manage their medical issue as well as getting the employer the information they need.
And what about individual absences, Sarah? When somebody's got a certification for intermittent leave and they can miss, again, the example is 1 day per week, how much notice do they have to give the employer if they're going to be absent?
So absent extreme circumstances, the FMLA still requires employees to follow the employer's normal call-in procedures. So if you have reasonable call-in procedures, for example, saying that the employee needs to call in at least an hour before the start of their shift, in a typical situation, if the employee doesn't do that, they can be disciplined for violating that call-in procedure. Now, if the employee is in a coma, you may need to give them a pass on that, but you can seek medical verification from the doctor that they were unable to follow that call-in procedure due to the medical condition. If not for a doctor certifying that fact, you can hold them to your typical call-in procedures.
And I think it's helpful when the certification comes back and the employee comes in and maybe turns it in, that the employee and human resources will sit down and have a discussion about what the certification means, what the call-in procedure might look like, what the expectations are. So there's no confusion on either side of that table in terms of what the paperwork's going to mean moving forward.
Absolutely. And I think it's also important that the employee understand that they do need to let us know, and the law does allow us to require at that point that they do report for each absence that it is FMLA, or they at least reference the underlying condition. Because often employees are absent for FMLA reasons, but also have the typical absences. I had the flu, or my car didn't start, or things like that. And those are not protected by the FMLA. So we are entitled to have them report enough information so that we know whether it's an FMLA absence or something else.
Now, we're fortunate right now to have very, very low unemployment here in Wisconsin and really across the country. And so a lot of our clients are working mandatory overtime. And even though employees are getting paid time and a half for that overtime, some of them, quite frankly, don't want to work the extra hours. We've had a number of employers dealing with FMLA certifications that limit workers to a 40-hour work week or an 8-hour work day. Sarah, can that be legitimate under the Family and Medical Leave Act?
It can, and that's one of the frequent questions that I get, because it is a frustrating situation. You need somebody there to get the job done. And I think some employers have the sense of, well, if they can do the job for 40 hours, why can't they do the extra few hours? But there are some medical conditions that legitimately may mean fatigue sets in, or the condition is such that the employee can work for a certain period of time, but then it becomes unsafe, or they become unable to work more than that. So it certainly can be a basis for FMLA. It's important that employers track that properly. If an employee is using FMLA in a week where there is overtime, the FMLA is structured in terms of weeks. That employee is going to use a partial week. And so you have to make sure that you're defining that partial week accurately based on the fraction of hours used over the hours that the employee was assigned that week. So if they typically work a 40-hour week, but this week they were going to work 5 hours of overtime, they missed only those 5 hours of overtime. They missed 5 out of 45 hours that week. And so you have to use that fraction to convert. And that's one thing that is a challenge for many employers. And so just getting the math right is important. Some employers decide, it's too burdensome, I'm just not going to count it at all. And I think that's a difficulty too, because then you have employees missing work regularly and never being held accountable for it.
That's a really good tip as well. A lot of employers and employees think they get 12 40-hour work weeks of leave, so 480 hours. Well, if it's a 30-hour-a-week employee, it's going to be 360 hours. But again, to Sarah's point, it should be calculated on a work week basis, 12 weeks of leave.
So I think there are a number of challenges that come with managing intermittent FMLA. And it is really a balance of an employee's legitimate rights under this law. And, you know, thinking about if it were us or our loved ones, we would want the benefits of this law as well, and balancing that with the needs of the business. And so using the tools that are built in to the regulations and the law and the paperwork and procedures that go with that to manage those issues.
One more example before we wrap up. One of the old acronyms for the Family Medical Leave Act is the Friday-Monday Leave Act, because you've got a suspicious pattern where an employee takes Fridays and Mondays off. When you see that, Sarah, what can you as an employer do to help understand the situation and make sure there isn't fraud or abuse occurring?
Absolutely, because I think most employees use the FMLA legitimately, but there are always those that might abuse. And again, it's using the paperwork, the process under the regulations. So for example, in that circumstance, you can seek recertification with a cover letter to the doctor saying, I know that this person is certified to be off, you know, 3 days a month, but it happens that they're always the Fridays, or the pattern is such that it seems as though maybe they're just trying to extend their weekends, or it's always the day of a particularly onerous task or something like that. You can seek recertification from the doctor to say, is this pattern of leave necessary? There are also circumstances where some employers may want to seek surveillance. That's rare, but there are times when it is appropriate. I had a case recently where an employee had asked for time off for non-medical purposes and it was denied. And then she suddenly needed to leave in the middle of the day. And surveillance may have been helpful in that circumstance to see where she was going.
That's a great tip. And Sarah, I really want to thank you for joining me today and talking about your experiences with administering the Family and Medical Leave Act. Would you join me next time and we can talk about the differences between the federal law and Wisconsin's Family and Medical Leave Act?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you all for joining us for another Ogletree Deacons podcast. Enjoy your day.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.